I'm Bill Giddings. I'm here from Pacific Lutheran University, located in greater downtown Parkland, Washington, just south of Tacoma. And I've chosen as the title for this morning's discussion, Modeling the Future. Most of us, I expect, are interested in the future. Since if nothing else, we hope to live there. We've all grown up with a whole variety of forecasts and visions of the future, from the prophets of old through today's newspaper. This morning, I'd like us to consider together what kinds of future prospects have been developed through more or less scientific approaches, written for the general public. Try to consider what approach was used for these particular studies, the general conclusions that were reached, what advice the authors had for us, and what reactions there have been to their particular points of view. The concerns of these studies center on questions of population, food, resources, and pollution. I intend to keep the discussion this morning quite general for several reasons. First, numbers may be boring to lots of people. Second, numbers are certain to be misleading if they're not carefully investigated. Third, numbers can be argued about endlessly, thereby obscuring the important questions of the general validity of the conclusions reached. Lewis Carroll, who in real life was the mathematician C.L. Dodgson, put forth a proposition that a controversy may be raised about any point, and at any distance from that point. And fourth, my library is going to arrive on the barge tomorrow. I did pull a few things from Holden's library to wave at you from time to time. We're not without resources here. The questions that we are considering are not new questions. It was some 200 years ago, I don't have that exact date in the things I found yesterday, that the English clergyman Thomas Malthus wrote an essay on population. Now, how does anybody go about predicting the future? What do you start with? What do you do with?
Start with what you've observed.
You start with what you've observed, the past, the present, and try to see what direction changes have been occurring from the past to the present. And then more often than not, you say, okay, that's the way it's been going, so that's the way we expect it will continue. And this is the approach that Malthus took, looking at population and food questions. He saw food supply as increasing, but in a straight line or linear fashion. He saw population increasing, but in an ever-rising curve or exponential fashion. Now, you can put these two things together in a variety of ways. You can say that perhaps there's not enough food now, in which case things are going to get worse and worse. Or you can say, well, we're barely making it on food now, but that's not going to last long. Or even if we say there's plenty of food now, even a little extra, sometime in the future, just given the shapes of these two projections, we're going to run into trouble. And that's the projection that Malthus made. He saw as the only solution conceivable, bad choice of word, the population question, he felt the only answer to that was sexual abstinence, and he saw no hope for that. So he said, sooner or later, mass mass starvation will result. Now, note again what approach he used. He started with some sort of a database, ideas or figures or whatever he had about birth rates and about agricultural production. Secondly, he applied a mathematical model, a straight line, a rising curve. And third, he projected the straight line and the rising curve into the future. Now, mathematical modeling has come a long way in the last couple hundred years. What's the tool used for mathematical modeling these days?
Computers.
And they can do a whole lot of things that Malthus could not. Modeling the world for the computer is an exercise that was begun at MIT by Jay Forrester back in the late 1960s, was further developed and reached its first really popular accounting under the leadership of Vanilla and Dennis Meadows, and was published in 1972 as The Limits to Growth. Anybody actually read this book? Well, I have because I've taught from it, but until that, I hadn't. The approach is still generally the same. Database, mathematical model, in this case, push the button and see what comes up. Inside the front cover, the National Observer, remember them? Suggests we should mark this book. It may be as important to mankind as the Council of Nicaea and Martin Luther's 95 Theses. It is a revolutionary new way of looking at man and society, closed quote. Now, is it really that new? In 1954, Harrison Brown, a geoscientist at that time at Caltech, published a book called The Challenge of Man's Future. He took the same considerations, reached the same general conclusions, had the same kind of blurbs on the cover saying how important this was, endorsed by Nobel Prize winners and other people. 1954. He didn't use a computer model. So the computer model is what was really new. Now, 1954 happens to be the year I graduated from college, went to graduate school. I heard of this book in 1976 when I was on sabbatical and had been working through this one. Furthermore, as far as population, the big attention getter there, probably 1968, Paul Ehrlich, the population law. But again, not a computer model and not an attempt to relate systematically the questions of population and food with those of resources, depletion, pollution, and model mathematically how these things affect each other. Those who criticize this approach call these people neo-Malthusians, harking back to the fact that Malthus had called attention to these problems quite some time ago. Well, what kinds of conclusions they come to? One is that things will not continue the way they've been going with ever-increasing, you name it, population, pollution, consumption. That sooner or later, within 70 years of their publication date, unless things change, something is going to overshoot the limits of the planet, ending with collapse, disaster, light spread, starvation, death from disease, whatever. So these have been called models of doom by the critics. But perhaps the critics haven't paid quite so much attention to the last chapter that says, if population growth can be halted, beginning right away, which for them was 1975, not suddenly, but realistic possibilities if people really took the message to heart. If industrial capital could be stabilized by 1990, maybe we've gone past that point in the other direction already. If resource consumption and pollution could both be cut to one quarter of their 1970 value per unit production, then if we could do all of those things, their model shows that for a future of 100 years, maybe we could achieve a state of global equilibrium, not continued runaway exponential growth, but what my friend and colleague Bob Stivers entitles his book as the sustainable society. Well, what might be a problem with computer modeling? What can computers do for you? Only what you tell them. The input determines the output. Well, these people told their computer to look at the entire world as one unit. So they averaged out everything. And that's been a serious and valid criticism. They had some 300 mathematical equations relating the impact of various economic, technical, resource, population, statistics, relationships, and that may not be enough fairly to represent the whole world. 2 years later came the second report to the Club of Rome from the Project on the Predicament of Mankind. Both these reports were supported by the Volkswagen Foundation. This second report, 1974, is called Mankind at the Turning Point. It's a bigger and better computer model. Authors here, Mihailo Masarevich from Case Institute, Case Western, I guess it's called Case Western Reserve, and Eduard Pestel from Hanover, Germany, have some 100,000 mathematical relationships built in, and they don't try to average the whole world. They divided it first into 10, now into 12 different regions with different regional characteristics. Didn't treat them separately, they were interactive units, but didn't try to lump the whole Earth and all of its people and all of its problems into one average. You cannot, of course, model political activity mathematically the way that you might hope to model population dynamics on a large scale or resource depletion or whatever. So, to answer that criticism of the computer modeling approach, these people design ways to put in various assumptions of policy choices that might be made. Will China emphasize heavy industry, agricultural production, whatever, by what relative amounts? Try it and see how that would work out. They call these scenarios. So you don't get just one fixed output from the information of past and present that you put in. You can test out the likely effects of various policies. And they've been trying very hard to get heads of governments and legislative bodies to play this game, this deadly earnest game. Well, what were their conclusions, do you suppose? One, we can't go on as we had been. But we could make some conscious choices. If we were to opt for what they call organic growth, rather than random growth in all directions, then by choosing wisely those directions of growth, we might not have to stop growth. Secondly, that we must reduce two gaps which have been growing up to then, and I would venture up to now, the gap between man and nature, and the gap between the rich and the poor, the north and the south. Third, they make the point that Harrison Brown had made in 1954, and many since, that of course, if there's a nuclear war, all your computer models are completely meaningless. Furthermore, they say the impact of arms race escalation, even if it doesn't result in nuclear war, cannot be modeled. So you have to assume that somehow the world is going to manage its way through that problem, or no one can offer any solutions. Still, they say, delay is deadly. Waiting 25 years to begin, and they took a shorter range look, looking more substantially at 25-year projections, because the farther you project into the future, of course, the greater the uncertainty, the more things are going to change in directions you can't really predict. They say these crises of population, food, resources, pollution are not temporary. That solutions to these problems will require a global context in our decision making. That we need to develop a much greater world consciousness than they had seen by that time. And that these problems cannot be solved by traditional means. That a new ethic will be needed to deal with such overwhelming concerns. Well, some people were and are still unconvinced by this kind of argument. They say that all of these people are doing two things. One, they're selling human ingenuity short. Malthus predicted that mass starvation would have occurred a long time ago. Starvation on that scale did not occur. What went wrong with his projection? It was not that population didn't grow exponentially, but that food production also grew exponentially because of technological change. People learned how to grow more food on the same amount of land. And to Malthus back then, of course, the limit on food was the limit on good land available to grow. Most people say that we could now adequately feed the present world population with the presently known resources and presently available methods if the problems of distribution could be solved. Secondly, besides ignoring or selling short the possibilities of improved methods of dealing with the questions, they say that crying wolf is counterproductive. That we may say, well, this is hopeless, despair, and not bother to do the things we could do. Then the doomsday prediction becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you believe it, it will happen. Actually, it seems to me, if you pay close attention to the last chapters in the book, if you believe it, then you'll get motivated to try to do something and make it a self-defeating prophecy, which is, of course, the whole hope and aim of the authors, that people will listen and do something different so that the future will not be such a disaster as the present course would lead them to expect if we don't take their advice. Now there has been a more recent computer model attempt to project the future. 1980, the Global 2000 report. This is different in several ways. First of all, this is different because it is an official document from the United States government. It is the Global 2000 report to the president, which was prepared at the direction of President Carter under the auspices of the Council on Environmental Quality and the U.S. Department of State, available from the U.S. government printing office. Secondly, it is different from Limits to Growth and Mankind at the Turning Point in that it does not use one elaborate computer model. The reason for that is that the United States government doesn't have one. It has a variety of agencies, each of which, of course, has elaborate computer models. The Department of Agriculture has theirs for food production. The Census Bureau has theirs for population predictions, and so forth. Many partial models which overlap and which are at various points incompatible with each other, so that you can't come out with one result that really takes everything into consideration in taking a systematic look at the future. Well, given those differences, how about their conclusions? Volume one of the report in three volumes is the major findings and conclusions, and its manageable size and manageable language. They say, if present trends continue, if present trends continue, same way all of these have begun, the world in 2000 will be more crowded, more polluted, less stable ecologically, and more vulnerable to disruption than the world we live in now. Begins to sound depressingly familiar, having gone through these earlier projections. Serious stresses involving population, resources, and environment are clearly visible ahead. Despite greater material output, the world's people will be poorer in many ways than they are today. For hundreds of millions of the desperately poor, the outlook for food and other necessities of life will be no better. For many, it will be worse. Barring revolutionary advances in technology, life for most people on Earth will be more precarious in 2000 than it is now, unless the nations of the world act decisively to alter current trends. This, in essence, is the picture emerging from the U.S. government's projections of probable changes in world population, resources, and environment by the end of the century, as presented in the Global 2000 study. They do not predict what will occur. Rather, they depict conditions that are likely to develop if there are no changes in public policies, institutions, or rates of technological advance, and if there are no wars or other major disruptions. A keener awareness of the nature of the current trends, however, may induce changes that will alter these trends and the projected outcomes. The problems of preserving the carrying capacity of the Earth and sustaining the possibility of a decent life for the human beings that inhabit it are enormous and close upon us. Yet there is reason for hope. Tried to indicate that we've heard that before in these other studies also. It must be emphasized that the Global 2000 study's projections are based on the assumption that national policies regarding population stabilization resource conservation, and environmental protection will remain essentially unchanged through the end of the century. But in fact, policies are beginning to change. 1980. In some areas, forests are being replanted after cutting. Some nations are taking steps to reduce soil losses and desertification. Increases in energy conservation, interest in energy conservation is growing, and large sums are being invested in exploring alternatives to petroleum dependence. The need for family planning is slowly becoming better understood. Water supplies are being improved, and waste treatment systems built. High-yield seeds are widely available, and seed banks are being expanded. Some wildlands with their genetic resources are being protected. Natural predators and selective pesticides are being substituted for persistent and destructive pesticides. Encouraging as these developments are, they are far from adequate to meet the global challenges projected in this study. So this is volume one, and that's just a few paragraphs from the introduction to volume one. They go through giving tables and charts of gross national product, projected population, agricultural production, grain consumption, water availability, and all metal consumption, and all kinds of things. If that isn't enough, then volume two is the technical report. And if you want to investigate further how they got all of this output from the computer, then volume three is what they call the documentation on the government models, saying what they put into the computer and how they told the computer to deal with it, for those who can speak that language. So there we are in 1980. Once again, the conclusions of the Global 2000 study have not gone unchallenged. One of the leading critics, name, I believe, is Julian Simon. I think he's at the University of Illinois. And he says once again that we are still, in this study, selling short the possibilities for technical innovation. He points out that many of these earlier projections have not, in fact, happened. If we look back to Ehrlich in 1968, prologue to the population bomb, the battle to feed all of humanity is over. In the 1970s, the world will undergo famines. Hundreds of millions of people are going to starve to death, in spite of any crash programs embarked upon now. At this late date, 1968, nothing can prevent a substantial increase in the world death rate, although many lives could be saved through dramatic programs to stretch the carrying capacity of the earth by increasing food production. Simon says, that didn't happen. And some of the reports you read about famine were grossly exaggerated also. They were not based on actual data and were misinterpretations of some field reports. He also says, as in fact the Global 2000 report itself said, that population growth in many areas has already sharply declined, including some of those areas which were previously very rapidly growing. That decline had already taken place in the more highly developed areas of the world, like Western Europe and the United States. Now, since 1980, of course, those to whom the report was originally addressed are now out of office. There are people who are trying to ensure that the message does not go unheard. There's a voluntary coalition of groups that have been formed to try to follow up on the recommendations of the Global 2000 report. This year, throughout the United States and other countries, there is a movement calling itself the Planetary Initiative, that is trying to inform and involve the general public. There is such a group working in Tacoma, one in Seattle. I don't know anything about specific groups in other cities. And they are quite properly trying to raise first the question of what futures are desirable, what directions would we want to go, before deciding what choices we might make, again, among choices that are within the range of possibilities. So, we have, as usual, a variety of opinions. The published studies that I've tried to give as sort of an extended book report this morning all seem to lead in one direction. I haven't given equal attention, haven't found the books in the library here that take the other point of view. Who are you going to believe? How do you decide? I'm asking you. Most of us, particularly me, are not going to go look deeply into the computer model and go out for ourselves to evaluate the data.
There are some basic, obvious problems. Depletion of resources, no question. At some point in time, we're going to be in real trouble.
Yes. So what shall we do about that?
I also question whether the fact that since the 1700s, a great deal more land has been brought into production, partly because of this technological advances, but also just because there was more land available, it seems to me that we're getting close to the end of the available land
reintroduction. I think it would be fair to say that most of the best land certainly is already in production, and that further increases will be more marginal land.
Yeah, in fact, it's going on further beyond the agricultural uses for making food, further on into the high best use of industry. And that's what's happening in every valley from California to the top of Canada where there's any decent weather at all. Every single valley is being industrialized except the Nisqually Delta, and they're working hard to get that one. And I think maybe a couple of others that are trying to protect it. And that's it.
Yeah, we're from the Bay Area, and it's always been kind of interesting to me that down there the environmentalists are working so hard to save the rich lands as open space, and everybody's building in the valleys.
Houses and over the cabbage patches. I mean,
you
should be building houses on the
and
blocks.
They're saying fields. They keep telling us that if they put houses in the hills, they're going to have so much more pollution because of the transportation problems of transporting people into the hills. But the other side of that is that, yes, but if you cover up all your farmlands with houses, then where is the food going to come from? And we live in an area where we've got beautiful weather, but food's getting quite expensive. And I worked last year in a low
income. What do some of the poorer countries do about their farmland? The people that we are feeding, India, what are they doing in Africa? What are the leaders of those countries doing with some reports like this? We cannot feed the whole world. Is anybody trying to help them learn to feed themselves?
Well, yes, with varying degrees of success. And part of very large part of the problem is, of course, farming American style can't be transplanted.
That's right.
To tropical regions. For several reasons, of course, the soils are different. The tropical forest soils are really very poor. Most of the nutrients are locked up in the vegetation rather than being down there in the soil. That with the climate differences, the crops, of course, would have to be different. Furthermore, farming American style requires vast amounts of energy, water, technological equipment, fertilizers, pesticides that these countries could in no way afford.
Why can't they be taught to farm their style? Why do they have to farm our style?
Some of them want.
Sure.
And some of them are taught theirs, do learn their style and get much more tonnage per acre because of it than has gotten American farms.
That's true. I would also venture to say that the people are hungry there because their style doesn't provide enough for their needs. And who is going to teach them how to improve their style to meet their needs better? Who knows? Who is going to do the research of what is best in their situation? We can't tell them because we don't understand their situation.
Well, they certainly send enough foreign students here to talk to our agriculturalists mm-hmm. about what their country is like, what their farmland is like. Don't some of those people go back to their own home country and help their own people?
Well, yes.
I don't expect Indians to learn how to farm with our farm machinery when a cow will do just as well for them. There is a lot of farm machinery sitting around over there that broke down and nobody to fix it.
But then I'm no expert on anything.
What about population control? Are these countries doing anything?
Yes, China has done.
Well, China, yes, but I mean the countries that are free.
Very coercive methods. India has had an extremely active program, which they've been exceedingly disappointed in the results. Many of the South American countries, of course, are still dominated in some ways by Roman Catholic dogma that limits very drastically the approaches to population control that are acceptable to the people themselves. And what are we going to do about that?
Also, there are places in the world where the resources and the limitations and population problems are so great that were they farming by the best available methods, they'd still not have enough.
I did hear what some of these people had to say to us in that I had the chance to observe the World Council of Churches conference on faith, science, and the future that was held at MIT, the Mecca of Technological Society, back in 1979. And one thing they point out is, you talked to us about population control. 19 of our citizens use less of the world's resources than any one of yours.
I think we have to tackle the problem of distribution because it's just terrible for us to take the lion's share, our share.
A lot of times when we look at population problems, I think we tend to look at the underdeveloped countries. When we were in England a few years back, I was had a long conversation with my brother-in-law who was there doing a dissertation at the time, and England was at that time importing 50% of all of the protein they consumed. And that's after a couple of hundred years of exporting population.
Mm-hmm. And what you said, you know, people don't think about that because American population growth has slowed, but if we remember that each of us consumes so much more than any, you know, than people in other countries, along with our population slowing the growth of our own, you know, we need to cut how much each of us consume. You know, there's no question about it.
another thing which they said to us was, don't talk to us about limits to growth. You're just trying to keep us where we are so that we won't get what you have. And so if technological civilization should fall, so what? Won't make any difference to the poor. They haven't got any of it now. So they aren't interested in that equilibrium society.
So they may be a little interested in how we fall, if we take the whole planet with us.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wasn't there another comment about, in that same conference, the technologically advanced nations were saying, gee, we've encountered so many problems with pollution and other problems with high technology that we really feel like the developed countries should not have that in order to avoid those problems. And one of the representatives from the underdeveloped nations said, please let us have your problems for 10 years so that we can have the way of living that we have.
Rather have our problems than theirs.
Right.
I don't think many of us would care to go move and take on their problems. Well, what special concern to us as Christians do we have with these questions? And these are books approached from presumably scientific basis with mathematical models that themselves have no particular moral content, but attempt to express relationships as observed, the way things are, the way things do work. What is our duty to our neighbor?
It seems to me that the kind of information you've presented here this morning always leaves me somewhat depressed because it seems too big, too much for me to cope with. Therefore, my only response to it is that under God, what I do in my personal life along the lines of live simply that others may simply live, put together with every other Christian's motivation doing that same sort of thing, will under God have some effect, because I cannot in any terribly significant way influence the national policy about who you'll feed and who you won't and all that kind of thing.
What you have to have is 100 million other views like that.
But that always has to begin with me. I mean, yes. I can't just say, well, I can't do anything. Yes, I can. I can do what I can do, and I can trust God to multiply that.
Yes. Well, I was going to say exactly the same. That the only thing we can do is to live simply that others may simply live. But really do it. And what I'd like to see here is discussions on how we really can live more simply. I mean, we have that phrase, it's so nice, but then we see a dress and we go out and buy it. Do we then take one of our dresses and put it in the Salvation Army? Mm-hmm. Do we deprive ourselves in any way? Or food or whatever, do we have fast days and so forth? And as we say, under God, if we multiply this, I think whatever we bring to the Lord, we multiply it.
Yeah.
I can't help but think at this point of what Dan Erlander said in the Bible study this morning, pointing out how God used Caesar Augustus to get Mary and Joseph to Bethlehem, where Jesus was to be born. And he says, well, when God's through using the Soviet Union, and it's a little harder to hear the same thing about the United States. I don't think he intended us to say, well, we'll leave it all to God without arguing anything about it. I would point out that the Global 2000 report places the responsibility on nations, not just individuals, and that our nation is supposed to be responsive to individuals collectively. I'm curious as to how much any of you may have heard of the Global 2000.
My husband bought it. at the government printing office.
Charlie Mays keeps talking about it. So you have to I remember a few articles in the newspaper when I came out, and I think in terms of public awareness, that's it that I was aware of.
What directions do you see in the last couple of years as far as national policies that they're on?
Very depressing.
Very in it. Wow. Yeah.
But I think our own 1980 census was another one that was a very significant document in America.
Particularly?
Particularly such things as the percentage. Who are the poor people in America? You know, and how is their life being impacted by?
And how are they counted, if they're counted? That was the thing that impressed me so much. They said they didn't even go in because they were too afraid to count the people in certain areas. So the poor in those areas weren't even counted.
When they are not countable.
I had the experience 15 years ago of teaching in a school district in California, which had a large percentage of migrant children. And the local school district, which was very conservative, did not wish to service kindergarten children from the migrant labor camp, so they simply refused to send a school bus.
That's pretty easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's so one way we do it, discrimination, too.
Right.
Not send a school bus.
Right.
Wasn't there a recent court case ordering the school district in Texas to serve the children of the illegal aliens?
Sure. But in California, kindergarten is not a required program of the public schools. And so there's all sorts of discretion. And so middle class kids, yes, they all come with 2 years of nursery school and kindergarten. Mm-hmm. The lower middle class kids maybe get the kindergarten, and the poor come into first grade unprepared. You know, I mean, it's not quite that clear cut. But when you get into some of these little backcountry districts and see who's making the decisions and what some of the
impacts the local control, which I think is very interesting.
And I
37 programs from the handicapped in the state of Washington, they just cut 37 programs, which I find very interesting. They are now, you know, this is coming down to local control. Well, that just means that there's no programs for a whole bunch of people.
Right. And if you have children who have special needs that can't be identified on any particular test, they'll be in a kindergarten class with 32 or 33 other kids, and
they'll all go crazy.
Right. So it's I think in these areas, individuals can make a lot of impact. If they only see where their own local power system is. We live in a community of 100,000 people, and there's a school board meeting, there are 10 people in the audience.
Well, I can tell you how to increase the attendance at those meetings, and that is to close a few schools.
Oh, yes, they did that. They closed a third of them 5 years ago, and people went crazy for 6 months. And,
yep, you know, you got it. We closed our best grade school this last spring, the best institution to teach in that there was in the entire district. And we came to the conclusion they closed it because they didn't want one great school among their good schools. And it's kind of a jealousy thing, you know, equalize it all perfectly. And
well, it's hard, you know.
It's impossible.
I hear us saying that our neighbors are where we find them, and that we need to be concerned for those in our own school district as well as those on the other side of the globe, and that we need to participate actively in the decision processes as well as, not instead of, but as well as making our own witness in our own lifestyle. Now, how do you find out particularly on hunger issues, which seem to be the most immediate of these problems here. How do you find out when and where to apply pressure on what kind of a bill in Congress, for example?
Do you know the answer to that?
Sure.
I know the answer to that question. It's very simple. You join Bread for the World, and for $10 or $15 a year, you get every month, at least, the information of what bills are up, which are the key congresspersons, as well as an indication of the impact that people writing their own letters can make and have made. The Tacoma Bread for the World group is sponsoring a discussion with the two candidates for the 6th Congressional District to explore their attitudes on hunger issues. Now, of course, there are also people that have concern for attitudes on armaments issues. These are not unrelated. Of course, you may find that one candidate comes out to a place you think is closer to right on the food issue and maybe not on the armaments or whatever. Still, if you don't know, you can't take that into account on voting. And that, of course, is one of the things that we're going to be asked to do very soon.
I just wanted to say one thing. I hope we can all think globally and think in terms of the Earth as a spaceship, and that we should be as concerned to stock our Earth in the same way we would sending in space vehicles out of outer space.
And that's part of the both the global viewpoint and the new ethic that mankind's turning point says will be necessary. Of course, things like that don't happen without a whole lot of people becoming active in the educational process, not only educating themselves, but others. I have one final question that bothers me. Our political and economic system, we look at the results of it, we compare it with other places, and I don't see any place I want to move to instead. But how does it adapt to need for long-range planning? There is no U.S. government agency responsible for systematic long-range planning.
And the thing you just pointed out, the administration that initiated that study is all gone. Mm-hmm. And so
really gone.
And like Joanne Holt was saying yesterday, you know, we replaced people, you know, that do very well what they want them to do because they don't pursue certain interests, and so it doesn't get done. And I think this has been the most discouraging change in administrations, in a series of discouraging administrations, because it's just so opposite. I mean, any work that was begun has been either stopped completely or dismantled. And so whenever we do get a different administration, they'll have to start all over again. And then maybe 4 years later, it'll be switched again.
I disagree with that, actually. You know, this change has stimulated a great many discussions such as this that weren't going on.
Well, I think that's true.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at some point, and I see this pendulum kind of swinging, and I think at some point it starts to come back, and it may have already started, I'm not sure. It may be just the people that I'm around, but I have a feeling that it's going to come back. And I think, you know, if we're fortunate enough to have people who are really conscious of things that have gone before, they'll be able to pick up at a higher base than they were before.
But that still doesn't speak to the long-range plan. Just try your planning, your local planning body, wherever you are. Okay. You'll discover long-range means, 1990. We worked on a plan for 5 years for our area. It's one of five in the county. And when we got through, we almost died to discover that it's good to 1990 in their eyes. That's it. We were thinking, you know, 50 years down the pike. That's what we were thinking when we were drawing up our plan. It was a shock when we ran into the public hearings to hear our planner say 1990, we never do less than.
Well, these very same factors that interfere with projections and some quirks and things that you didn't think of, you didn't put into the computer. The anticipation of such things occurring along the way is in some way a part of inhibiting long-range planning, because you really want to foist your observations on generations down the line. And maybe the way to do it is to project it and plan it, but leave it open to change.
Yeah, but there are irreversible things. We are doing in our environment irreversible things, period.
Yes.
And that's where I get into the long-range planning problem. We tried in our plan to say, if the soil and the land and the environment and so on will support whatever it is you want to do, then if you tell us, you know, or work it out within the plan, then you can do just about anything you want to do. Well, the planner's freaked out. They have to have absolute regulation number 67.200.8, and it says, you know, they have no imagination whatsoever about what the land might be able to support. If it's a swamp, God buys it, well, then you get a whole piece of roadbed from the county that they're ripping up, and you put it in the swamp and you build on it. That's what that's always been, and it will always be, unless somehow we can say a swamp is a useful thing. It cleans the water, and you know, the water running through it or down into it, it's a good place to hold water if you have too much water running around too fast. All kinds of good things about swamps that no one knows anything about. They don't realize the natural systems work if they're left natural.
And the state of California defeated
right. The
Central Canal. You know, they wanted to run a river backwards down the state, and there were a number of people who looked at that and said, you know, that's just not sound planning.
We dumped our bottle bill last time. It's coming up again.
I think that. What this place is about is we come here, we talk about these things, and then we go forth. Mm-hmm. And I think it's time to do that this morning. Thank you for coming.